This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Speaking of crazy, Lori Vallow Daybell was in court just the other week. She had a new hearing, and just like Brian Koberger, just in that a different sort of chaotic, dark triad of narcissistic thinking, she too doesn't like the idea of paying back restitution. Doesn't think she should have to do it. Why? Well, other people have done it. And it all goes back to GoFundMe. Well, GoFundMe's paying this to people. Why should I have to? Because you're the one that was convicted of the crime. Isn't it fascinating that some people will take that GoFundMe that, well, somebody else is already providing that for them, so that should be good enough for me.
Yeah. You know, where you did the crime, you should pay.
Yes. I mean, where in history has this ever been like this, where it's like, well, someone else is going to make you whole, so why should I have to? I mean, if you get a civil judgment against you, there's no like, well, you already got whole from your GoFundMe, so I'm off the hook for that now.
Right.
And somehow think that arguing that aloud, speaking that into the atmosphere, into the world, is somehow going to make it happen. Yeah. But that's the magical narcissistic thinking that these people have. Let's watch some of this. It's a short piece of the hearing of Lori Vallow Daybell. And then after that, we're going to watch a little bit of Chad telling ghost stories.
And CR 2022-001-242, State of Arizona versus Lori Daybell. Is Ms. Daybell on? Is that the Joab Fedorf?
It's talking about the
Mr. Lund, can I have you turn your camera off just to not be a distraction?
Oh. There we go. Lori has shown up on the camera.
All right. I called the case. Let's have a state announce.
Trina K on behalf of the state.
And defendant?
Lori Daybell for the defense.
All right. I can hear everyone fine. This is the time set for restitution hearing. Have there been any agreements?
Your Honor, I am not sure. I was going to check with Ms. Daybell if she would stipulate to anything. I do have one correction in the documents. On bait stamp 101133, what we've learned is that the gas receipts that were provided are not all of the gas receipts, and so that's why we had done the mileage. But we forgot to remove the gas receipts themselves. So we should actually remove $348.98, which would make the total restitution request $8,600.54.
Okay. I'll ask the defendant, are you stipulating to any restitution?
Your Honor, on Wednesday night, I did receive those Bates numbers that were supposed to be given to me from my advisory council. They mailed them to me. I just got them. I was able to review those. Those ended at Bates number 101161. And yesterday, I was informed by my advisory council that the state sent over one more document on Tuesday by email to my advisory council. And I have not seen that document. It's Bates number 101162. It is my understanding, since I talked to my advisory council yesterday, that that document is a document. They kind of explained what it was to me. And so my understanding is, and although I'm aware that counseling, thank you, although I'm aware that counseling costs can be included in restitution, this document turned over by the state is an Excel spreadsheet totaling $3,147 in counseling. There are no invoices from doctors or insurance companies, to my knowledge. So the document in and of itself seems to be insufficient. I haven't actually seen it. However, based on how my trials were conducted, since experience tells me that regardless of what I say or what anybody else says, you're going to order it, I am willing to stipulate today. It is my understanding that I have already been ordered by this court to pay over $534,000 in fees, in fines, surcharges, and court fees. So you can add Ms. Woodcock's total of $12,096.97 of restitution to my tab.
And Your Honor, okay. With that correction, it would actually be $11,747.99.
Hold on. $11,747.99. All right. Ms. Daybell, you're stipulating to pay restitution to Kay Woodcock in the amount of $11,747.99. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Any drugs, alcohol, or medication in the last 24 hours that would affect your ability to have this, to make this decision?
Have I been on any drugs, Your Honor? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm asking, have you had any drugs, alcohol, or medication that would affect your ability to understand or make this decision today?
Is Your Honor aware that I am in prison? I have no access to any of those things. So no, the answer is no, I have not.
Well, then you're missing out, Lori.
Has anyone promised you anything in exchange for your agreement to pay this restitution?
No.
Has anyone forced you, threatened you, or coerced you to get you to agree to pay this restitution?
Only my trials, Your Honor, coerced me.
Oh, God.
All right. The court finds that your agreement is knowingly, intelligently, voluntarily made. It's ordered that you pay $11,747.99 in restitution to Kay Woodcock. The restitution would take priority over any other fines and fees that have been imposed. And it's ordered that that restitution be paid out at the maximum rate allowable out of any prison account. Ms. Kay, do you anticipate any other restitution requests?
Your Honor, we are still awaiting restitution requests from Brandon Boudreaux. I know that he's been busy with work and he hasn't got all of those documents together. When I get those, I will submit them to advisory counsel and to Ms. Daybell's investigator, who seems to be able to get that to her much easier. And just for the record, Ms. Woodcock is still ongoing counseling, so there could be subsequent requests.
Well, the court retains jurisdiction over the matter of restitution for the period that the defendant is serving a sentence. So I'm not setting any further hearings at this time. We'll wait and see if any requests for hearing come in. All right. Thank you. We'll be at recess.
Thank you.
And Lori just sits there blissfully unaware, shaking her head.
How rude. I mean, I'm sorry, but like you're in front of a judge. You've been, you've been, you know, sentenced and all this kind of stuff. Don't you have some?
No.
Because the rules don't apply to her.
No, they has no respect for this system whatsoever.
No, because the system doesn't go along with what she, I mean, this is just, you know, this is, the collapse has happened and we're in crazy land is basically where I think Lori Vallow lives. It's beyond collapse anymore. It's just, this
you
is
do
just,
realize I'm in prison, correct?
No shit, Sherlock.
Entertaining.
I don't know. If I were the judge, I wouldn't put up with that. I'd be like, I don't know. Do something
else. I think he's used to it now, Todd. I think he just goes, I got to ask the questions. I got to check the box saying I asked her this.
I was really hoping that during the trial they would have used the shock belt. Because she had one on. They literally had her hooked up to one where if she was going to get nuts, they could press the button.
I wish like they had,
And but they did not. Because she kept it kind of controlled, and I think she's a train wreck, so people just kind of want to watch it anyhow and go, oh my God, this is not good. The way restitution works in every state is a little bit different here, but in Idaho, 20% of whatever you make, and like, well, you're in prison. How do you make money? You can make money in prison. Mm-hmm. Like if you have a duty, a job, you can make like $25 a month cleaning the kitchen, whatever it may be. It's like chores basically. And you get severely underpaid, just like your parents severely would underpay allowances. And then 20% of that then goes into restitution. It also can happen if someone puts money into your account. So if there's an outside source, if somebody gives Lori $100, $20 mm-hmm. of that is going to go back to restitution. And then it gets divided out to all the places that restitution is supposed to be paid. So I know some people are wondering, how do they get money? That's how. That's why it's so important. In Idaho, there are also no Son of Sam laws. The Son of Sam law is the law that basically was in place for the Son of Sam murders, where you can't profit off of your crimes. You can't write a book and make $1 million. Some states have these. Some do not. Idaho does not. Meaning, in another case where we have the same sort of thing going on, Koberger arguing that the GoFundMe should just completely suffice the victims, is if Koberger were to get that money, that then he should not have to pay anything back. So if Koberger can write a book, Koberger can make money off of his crimes.
Dang it.
Yeah. That is there because there are no laws in that state that prohibit that from happening. I don't know if you got one in place now, if that would prevent it, because the law would go in place after the conviction. I don't know the answer to it. It's probably somewhat of a legal gray area. But that's why these things do matter, because of that. Now, you know, what's Koberger going to do with, you know, whatever he makes in commissary? It's a lot of Cheetos.
Right.
But only 20% goes back to pay that restitution. But that's why these things matter. They seem silly, but when that's all you have left, that's like the last little thing you can control, you know, they're going to fight for it. They're going to fight mm-hmm. for whatever bit of control they still have. So there's Lori. Really,
yeah. I kind of forgot how much I missed her. Is that just
don't we all?
Wrong? Yeah.
Don't we all miss Lori? I was so happy when it was done, but every once in a while, I don't mind a little visit to see what's going on in the land of crazy. Speaking of the land of crazy.
Yay, do we have time?
Her hubby. Yeah, it's a long piece. And he goes into, when he gets to musical taste, he basically goes on about Christian rock. And I don't really care about that. Let's listen to this. Let's listen to Chad Daybell's. We're going to go to letter number 7. You remember Chad letters from chad.com? They were supposed to be releasing like two a week.
Yes.
Like months ago. We've only have 7 so far after several months. I think they may have kind of gotten the hint. Maybe his kids have gotten the hint who are posting these, that this has turned into just pure comedy gold and not actually Chad getting to tell his story.
Right.
I'm happy to be part of destroying that. So hi, Chad's kids. If you have any clue in the world, go do something else. Don't waste your time on your shitty father.
No, we want to keep seeing these, Tony. Come on.
Well, it's, you know, someone finding, you know, a path in life that doesn't involve insanity or us getting the letters. I'm gonna go on the humane route and go do something else. Please get away as far as you can from these mad, crazy people that unfortunately you were born into. Just look at him as a sperm donor and not a good one.
Jeez, girl.
It's true. That's all he
had to go there.
That's how you're going to have to look at your dad, because he's a piece of shit. So this is letter number 7. And with it, this is fun because it's Halloween week, so it times out quite well.
Yes.
Chad is telling ghost stories. And I put together some lovely graphics with this if you're watching us on YouTube. If not, Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski. We're going to get to hear some ghost stories from Chad Daybell. Let's listen.
When I was Springville's cemetery sexton, most days were calm, but there were times when things got a little spooky. The most tangible ghostly experience I had happened after we buried a man named Eddie, who had been known in town as a petty thief. His burial spot wasn't far from my office, and almost immediately after his graveside service, strange incidents started occurring. For example, the morning after Eddie's burial, I arrived at work and noticed the gate to the enclosure where we parked the backhoe and dump truck was swung open. This was unusual because I always made sure the gate was locked as I departed each evening. I possibly left the gate open on accident the first time, but after the same thing happened the next 2 days, I strongly suspected Eddie was still picking locks and causing mischief, despite being dead. When I left for work after the third incident, I tucked a piece of plastic around the lock in a certain way so I could tell if someone touched it. I even drove back to check the lock that night after dark, and it was still fastened securely with the plastic in place. However, when I checked the gate early the next morning, it had been pushed open a few inches. The lock was undone, even though the plastic looked untouched. I wasn't amused by this ghostly prankster. The biggest surprise came moments later when I checked the shed next to my office. The shed had a padlock that required a key I kept on my keychain. But not only was the shed unlocked, but the padlock itself was hooked on a peg above the door. By this point, I wasn't scared. I was irritated. I figured Eddie was nearby, probably pleased I had noticed his handiwork. So I turned around and said, "Hey, Eddie, listen to me.
Hey, Eddie.
I'm impressed with your skills, but you're going to get me in trouble. What if someone sees the open gate and steals the backhoe? I'd get fired." I paused for a few seconds, then added, "Eddie, you don't belong here. There's a better place for you. Look around, go toward the light, and don't come back." He must have listened, because any problems with the locks stopped that very day. The Springville Evergreen Cemetery has a good, positive vibe, but there were a couple of areas where negative feelings were very strong. One section caused me anxiety, although there was no logical reason for it. I sensed I was treading on someone's territory, and they were bothered I was there. I'd never shared these feelings with anyone, though, until our cemetery secretary brought me a burial order. She pointed out the location, then said, "I hate that part of the cemetery. It gives me the creeps." I explained to her that I felt the same way in that area. She grimaced and actually shivered from head to toe. She said, "It feels like someone is playing with my hair when I'm over there." But my most frightening cemetery experience happened in another area. One woman's grave was well known for being supposedly haunted, and I avoided it. But it so happened someone died who would be buried in the plot next to the haunted grave. In order to put the new burial in the right spot, I would have to use one of our metal probing rods to push down through the soil and locate the concrete vault of the haunted grave. I've analyzed what happened in the next few seconds 1,000 times in my mind, but there is no denying that when the probing rod hit the vault, an electrical shock jolted my body. I dropped the rod and shook my arms until they stopped tingling. I wondered if I'd struck an underground power line, but it was impossible. I grabbed the probing rod once again, and this time when I touched the vault, it felt like somebody shoved me viciously in the chest. I took off running as fast as I could. I sensed an angry, demon-like spirit right on my heels, and it chased me all the way to my office. I could feel the demon clawing at me. Every inch of my body was covered in goosebumps, and I was praying out loud the entire way. My office was several hundred yards from the grave, but I covered the distance in record time. I was completely terrified. When I dug the grave with the backhoe the next day, I stayed as far from the haunted vault as I possibly could. I wasn't going to risk the chance of another violent supernatural encounter, and thankfully nothing happened. I later read the autobiography of Heber C. Kimball, a very prominent LDS church leader in the 1800s. He endured a demonic attack while on a church mission in England that reminded me of my own experience. He was struck with great force by some invisible power and fell senseless to the floor. Two other missionaries helped him sit on the bed. Then all three of them could distinctly see evil spirits who gnashed their teeth at them. Haber said, "We saw the devils in legions with their leaders who came within a few feet of us. They came toward us like armies rushing to battle. They appeared to be men of full stature, possessing every form and feature of men in the flesh, who were angry and desperate." He added, "I learned the power of the adversary. his enmity against the servants of God and got some understanding of the spirit world. Source, Life of Heber C. Kimball by Orson F. Whitney, pages 144 to 145. Thankfully, the positive cemetery experiences outnumbered the negative ones. Most graveside services carried a good feeling, and it was easy to sense that loved ones of the deceased were in attendance. These spirits were eager to welcome their friend or relative back home and to congratulate them on a life well lived. One tender moment for me was at the conclusion of an older woman's graveside service. She and I had been neighbors for several years, and I had sometimes assisted her with yard work and other mundane tasks. As her family members returned to their vehicles, it felt like she came to my side. I could sense how happy she was to graduate and continue on with her eternal journey. A warm sensation filled my heart, and I sensed she was thanking me for the help I had given her over the years. I was filled with an assurance that we'd see each other again in a future day. It was also at the cemetery that I got the message to begin my career as an author. Writing books was another phase of my life I had seen in the video snippets shown to me during my near-death experience at La Jolla Cove, but I hadn't been given any context of when or how this would happen. I figured it would be later in life, not while I was still in my 20s. A big snowstorm had hit Springville overnight, so I got up early to plow the snow from the cemetery roadways. There was also a funeral coming that day, so I began shoveling a wide path across the lawn to the gravesite. Then from out of nowhere, I heard Grandpa Keith's familiar voice. He simply said, "It's time to write your books." I leaned on the snow shovel and said aloud, "That's great, but I have no idea what to write about." Almost immediately, the entire plot of my first novel filled my mind. I quickly finished shoveling the path to the gravesite. Then I took my lunch break and spent a few minutes jotting down a summary of the storyline. I worked on the book each night at home for the next few weeks. When I felt satisfied the book was ready, I submitted the manuscript to Cedar Fort Publishing. I was soon offered a publishing contract. To my surprise, the novel became a regional bestseller, and I ended up publishing my first 12 books with Cedar Fort. I was confident that my books were inspired from a heavenly source, and I knew writing them was helping fulfill my promise to Grandpa Keith. But it always helps when the adversary reinforces that you are on the right track. One night, as I was falling asleep, I heard a rustling noise outside our bedroom window. As I lay there, a dozen voices suddenly shouted in unison, "We hate your books." It was fairly loud, and I looked over at Tammy, but she hadn't awakened. Then they repeated the phrase. I jumped out of bed and looked out the window, but no one was there. The voices were high-pitched and certainly not mortal. I knew I'd been visited by evil spirits. Even though I couldn't see them, I sensed they were milling around my yard, and I could feel their anger at me. The LDS Church teaches that families can pray and dedicate their homes to protect against evil spirits, and we had done that when we moved in. But now I rededicated our home and expanded it to include all of our property. I asked Heavenly Father and His angels to remove these demons and stop them from returning. It was a relief to feel them depart, and we didn't have any more trouble with them after that. Although the encounter was frightening, it actually strengthened me to know the adversary and his demons weren't pleased with the books I was writing. Bookshelf.
Bookshelf.
I was employed as Springville's cemetery sexton for several years before moving into the book publishing world on a full-time basis. As I mentioned in an earlier letter, our book company started off with great success. Then in 2008, the entire publishing industry began feeling the effects of the Great Recession. At our annual booksellers convention, I met with other publishers, and we tried to reassure each other that our companies would survive. After all, during the Great Depression in the 1930s, the citizens had turned to books as their main form of entertainment during hard times. Well, history didn't repeat itself in this age of the internet. We were barely able to keep Spring Creek Books afloat. We did bounce back a few years later, but in the meantime, it was clear I needed to find a different full-time job. In a strange twist of fate, it meant a return for me to the cemetery business.
Right?
Spanish Fork's cemetery sexton was retiring, and I applied and got the job. In some ways, it was surreal, because when you grow up in Springville, your main rival is Spanish Fork. But I felt welcome, and I had great coworkers. I want to share a Spanish Fork ghost story, because it was a situation where I didn't see anything, but my two coworkers did. I'll call them Derek and Sam to protect their privacy. The story begins as we were filling a grave in the part of the cemetery where original settlers were buried. As Derek and Sam waited by the grave, I drove the backhoe to our dirt pile a few hundred yards away and returned with a scoop of dirt. As I got closer, I saw Derek and Sam both backing away from the grave. Sam was nervously pointing at something, and then Derek actually hid behind Sam. Something had clearly spooked them. I dumped the load of dirt in the grave, then turned off the backhoe and hopped out. Derek and Sam started shoveling the dirt as if nothing had happened. But then Sam asked me, "Did you see him too?" "What do you mean?" I asked. They looked at each other in surprise. Sam stammered for a moment before walking to a spot about 10 feet from the grave. He said, "There was a boy standing right here. He was watching us." Derek added that the boy was wearing old-style clothes and that he vanished into thin air when I got closer with the backhoe. I asked them if they could see through him, and they both shook their heads. Derek said, "I thought he was a real kid at first." He stood there for at least 30 seconds. We discussed that experience many times during the rest of the summer, and we marveled that both Derek and Sam saw the boy. I would always write down memorable cemetery stories such as this one, and I eventually published a nonfiction book titled One Foot in the Grave. The first version was published after I finished working for Springville City. I later updated the book with a new cover and added several of my Spanish Fork experiences. There are numerous funny stories included, along with a good description of what it is like to work in a cemetery. Despite these occasional humorous incidents, I always took my duties as sexton very seriously. I regarded it as a sacred honor to care for the cemetery grounds and to perform burials properly with professionalism. Most importantly, I always made sure the deceased were shown complete dignity and respect. I knew better than anyone that my employees and I were on holy ground with friends and relatives watching us from the other side. I'm grateful for that unique opportunity and for the experiences I had that made me a better person.
There we go. You want to hear more of that? We'll I'll post the full video later today on our YouTube channel.
I'm not sure what's scarier, his stories or his use of the term probing rod several times.
I was trying to not snicker because I'm like, wait a minute, did we just launch into his novel?
Probing rod. Hey, Lori, come here. It's probing rod night. We just had a delicious Stouffer's chicken dinner. Now it's time to use the probing rod together.
Is that what he calls it?
I mean, look, you're to the kids. He's a sperm donor from his probing rod. And that's your dad.
We just got a message. And sexton. Yes, Ed, and the term sexton is also interesting hearing him say that.
So there you go. There's some Chad Daybell ghost stories.
I needed that more than you probably even understand, Tony. That was perfect.
Yes, Todd, thank you, because I have been begging for this for weeks now. And we're sitting on number 7. We've just stopped at number 7, and it just pains my heart.
Chad, we'd like more.
Please?
Chad, if you're listening or if your kids are listening, please write us more.
Give us something.
Let's hear the holidays. I want to hear what the holidays were like for the Daybells. Yeah. I want to hear what happened at Thanksgiving. I want to hear about the turkey loaf. I want to hear about the canned cranberries. I want to hear about how, you know, that one Christmas, that one thing happened that changed you forever. We don't have to talk about it, you know, right now, but we'd love you to write about it and share it with us.
Just
I don't know
give
what that is,
that.
But share it. Share it with us, please. What do you think little Chad Daybell would have asked for Christmas when he was a kid?
A shovel.
Yeah,
I could see that. Practical use for a shovel.
The guy, every story he tells seems to come back around to a shovel. And I don't mean to make light.
Yeah.
I understand that there's so much tragedy in this story, but something about that, I just need to go to the other side and and find the humor because it's so effing dark. Please, no disrespect, but the guy is just sick.
Well, I think he enjoyed his life as a cemetery sexton. I mean, he talks about it seemingly fondly. And I suppose you could find joy in that. I enjoy cemeteries. I enjoy hanging out of them. If that was my plight in life and that's what was, you know, what presented itself as being the job, I don't know. I should make the best of it.
Jean just mentioned, she said, hopefully he'll get writing. The divine being will give him ideas for letters. Oh. I love it. Perfect.
Yes. It's coming to you soon, Chad. Tell us more. Tell us more.
Tell us what's in your heart.
Yeah. So there you go. Chad Daybell, letter number 7. He's leaving us hanging. Holidays are coming up, Chad. Come on. Deliver like Santa Claus. Deliver.
Chadley Claus.
You know you want to. All right. That's going to wrap up our program for today. Let us know your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and you will find us. And press subscribe, whatever podcast platform you are listening to us on, so you don't miss any of our coverage of this and the many cases that we got for you right here. All right. Until next time, for Stacey and Todd, I'm Tony. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.